ESG.
From Iowa Public Radio, I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange. Some of the Republicans mulling a bid for the White House are now speaking out against the tax cut plan struck between the president and congressional Republicans. Many Democrats are also unhappy with the compromise, but are changes possible without bringing down the entire House of Cards? This week, the embattled leader of the Republican National Committee announced he's seeking a second term, but faces multiple challengers, including a prominent former Iowan. In Virginia, two federal judges issued opposing rulings on the constitutionality of the federal health care bill. And finally, what will the death of U.S. diplomat Richard Holbrooke mean for American military action in Afghanistan? We'll discuss the latest political news next on The Exchange. But first, the news. Good afternoon. I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. It's Politics Day, and my guests are Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, and Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield professor and professor of political science at Grinnell College. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Well, as you know, debate continues in Congress over the tax cut plan, with liberals and conservatives alike unhappy with the compromise. Possibly tonight. Iowa's 1st District Congressman Bruce Braley this week said he had reservations about the extension of the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans. We want to hear from him.
Many of us have concerns about giving a $135,000 tax break to millionaires while at the same time we're raising taxes on anywhere between 25 and 50 million Americans who earn less than $40,000 a year.
Iowa Congressman Bruce Braley, Democrat from the 1st District. Mr. Moyer, let me begin with you. There are many Democrats or many members of the president's own political party who said, this is not what I signed on for, and this is not what people expect of Democrats.
Right. But I, in the last analysis, I think most of them are going to have to vote for the bill. I mean, there are some terribly important things for Democrats here, the extension of the unemployment benefits and the decrease in terms of payroll deductions are going to be very important in terms of stimulating the economy and, I think, creating jobs. And I think those are terribly important for Democrats. And this is the best bill they're going to get.
Mm-hmm. Professor Goldford, do they hold their nose and vote?
Well, pretty much so. The difficulty is that the Bush administration, in order to enact these tax cuts years ago, left kind of a ticking time bomb. In order to deal with various elements of the budget process, they stipulated that the tax rates would have to go back up to where they were previously as of the end of this year. So it's not as though the Democrats are in favor of passing a tax increase. The question is whether the Democrats will support Republicans in blocking a tax increase or return to the higher tax rates that the Bush administration provided for. And they do get quite a number of things, as Professor Moyer said. It's just a question of how much you have to swallow to get what you want.
And there are Republicans arguing that they're also having to swallow pieces they don't like. Last night on the floor in the Senate, Arizona Senator John McCain took issue with extending the tax credits for ethanol, also biodiesel, which are part of the compromise. Here's Senator McCain.
Call these ethanol favors the Hawkeye handouts. That's what this bill is all about. And I say to my colleagues, I'll vote for it, but it's not what the people said they wanted done on November 2nd.
Now, obviously, Senator McCain no longer a candidate for higher office who doesn't have to come through Iowa. Yeah. But Professor Goldford, there are parts of this bill that Republicans dislike.
That's right. They're not particularly thrilled about the extension of unemployment benefits, despite the fact there seem to be four or five people unemployed for every available job. There is a current among some Republicans that people aren't getting jobs because it's a lot easier to be on unemployment. So they think, as they've thought for quite a number of decades, that unemployment benefits foster unemployment. But as Charles Krauthammer said, a conservative columnist, in fact, the Obama folks and the Democrats get quite a bit more than what might have been reasonably expected by this, and Republicans aren't happy.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the Republicans get a cut in what the estate tax would be, and they also prevent what would be an increase on the very high income taxes.
That's right.
There's a lot in it for them, too.
What, though, about Senator McCain's comments that this is not what people voted for? Republicans had a sweeping election in November. What did people say in that election, Professor Moyer? Did they want the tax cuts extended? Because the president had campaigned against extending those for the highest 2% of the income earners in the country. What did the voters say?
My sense is what the voters said is we want lower unemployment. We want jobs. And I think it was sold to them that preventing a tax increase or preventing the end of the Bush administration tax cuts would affect the creation of new jobs. And I think that is what the voters were actually voting for.
And Professor Goldberg, what about President Obama? What does this mean for him? I mean, there are many who say he's angered his base and that that Democrats are annoyed by this. Does this hurt him in 2 years?
Well, that's hard to say. I think that he struggled under the perception that he can be rolled easily. You know, he's campaigned for quite some time the thought of getting past partisanship or being a post-partisan president or in somehow being above politics. But politics is about partisanship, and if you try to be bipartisan, it'll come around and bite you somewhere uncomfortable. And a lot of Democrats in his base think he's been rolled. They want him to get a baseball bat and just stand up for what their principles might be. But you always have the problem in a political party, and it's both of our parties, between the purists and the pragmatists. And the purists would rather jump off the cliff, flags flying, saying, in your heart, you know we're right, to borrow the old Goldwater phrase. And the pragmatists would rather get something done. A half a loaf is better than none, rather than jumping off the cliff.
We want to
To follow that up, had Obama held out to the very end, he might not have got as good a deal as he did, because he absolutely had to have the unemployment benefits increased and the payroll tax deduction.
He didn't want those to go up right at Christmas.
Getting the economy back on its feet.
The congressional Democrats' strategy didn't work. They deferred dealing with the tax issue until after the election, thinking it would be so divisive, and yet they found themselves in a weaker position after the election, given the results of that election.
Exactly.
We want to hear from you today. What did the election mean to you? What did you expect? Was this the kind of compromise you were hoping for? Or do you want to be one of those who says, no, stand firm? Join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Again, the number 1-866-780-9100. Remember, you can email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org, or you can find us on Twitter at IPR Talk. You know, we just talked about what this might mean for the president. It's interesting because of candidates that are looking toward a possible Republican bid for the White House are also weighing in. In fact, House Speaker Newt Gingrich was on Fox News Sunday, and here's how he described the tax cut plan.
Look, the number one challenge in America is jobs and paychecks. What Republicans ought to do is say to people who create jobs, how many years does the tax code have to be extended for you to make an investment decision? I mean, the goal is not to have an annual extension of the current tax code and have every business in the country trapped saying, well, I don't know, I want to make a 20-year investment in a factory.
But if let's say it's the compromise were 2 years or 3 years, would you sign on for that?
There is a number, but I would have the business leadership of the country describe the number.
Would business leaders describe a number, Professor Moyer? I mean, it would seem to me that many would say, no, I want the tax cuts to be permanent, at least in the business community. And that it would be doubtful to me they would find a 1 year, 2 year, 3 year number. They'd shoot for the stars.
I would agree with that. I mean, business people want uncertainty reduced, and any kind of temporary extension adds uncertainty. So my suspicion is that the only thing they really would be satisfied with is a permanent extension.
Professor Goldford, does this extension do the kind of, you know, work that everyone's talked about in bringing back jobs in time for 2012? Or do the Newt Gingrich's, Sarah Palin's, Mitt Romney's, all of them criticizing this compromise stand to benefit 2 years from now?
Well, you know, within probably 6 to 8 months or so of the Obama administration in 2009, he owned the recession. It's his problem to get us out of it. And by all reports, and I'm not an economist, but by all reports that I've read, it's going to be a slow recovery from the recession. And people tend to think after a certain point, if you're the guy whose name's on the doorpost, however problems arose, however they got there, your job is to fix that. And if people have the perception that that job has not been taken care of and the problems aren't fixed, the person with his name on the doorpost will be punished. Now, at the same time, there can be, and again, as I said, I'm not an economist, so there are all sorts of reasons why tax cuts might be good or tax cuts might be bad, but you've got to remember on the Republican side, they will always find a reason, no matter how tortured or convoluted, to make an argument for a tax cut, because that's just an article of religious faith for them, as opposed to a particular pragmatic issue. So the case may be a good one, but you've got to address it very carefully.
All right. Let's talk to Daryl in Cedar Rapids. Daryl, thanks so much for calling the Exchange today.
Thank you. And just the more I hear about issues that come up, I think, and I'm reminded constantly that the decisions either party makes are really to cater not even to their voting base, but to the special interests that fund so many of their campaigns. I think most people would honestly be in favor of extending unemployment benefits. I think most people would be against a tax break for the rich. But the compromise they make is just, I'll get what I want, you get you what you want, and the voters left completely out because we're not in the system at all. Campaign finance reform isn't here. Term limits aren't enforced. And frankly, we've seen a switch between giving the voters going almost completely Democrat just 2 years ago to almost completely Republican in just 2 years. We're disenfranchised. We're alienated. And this just proves it again.
Daryl, thanks so much for your call. Professor Moyer, what about that argument that this compromise represents what the maybe he believes is the far right wants and the far left wants, but not what the center wants?
Well, I'm in sympathy with what the speaker, Daryl, is saying. The difficulty, of course, is we elected a Republican House of Representatives and increased the number of Republicans in the Senate, and we should have known in advance that they would be opposed to a tax increase for the very wealthy.
Yeah, so people should – this should be the assumption, and this is what they put in place, and maybe this is what they wanted then. Or like Daryl, do they sometimes vote – was it more a vote of anger about the current situation and maybe not thought through what the end result would be?
Well, I think that's a problem because people vote very generally in elections and without thinking very carefully about what the specific stands that candidates are likely to take on a number of different issues. And I think this one has come back to haunt a lot of people who would not want tax increases for the very rich.
All right. Let's turn to Michael Steele, the chair of the Republican National Committee. His two-year term was considered by many kind of gaffe-prone, but he announced this week that he's going to seek a second two-year term. He does face multiple challengers, including his former political director, Gentry Collins, who has accused Steele of gross financial mismanagement. And Gentry Collins is a fairly known name in Iowa in political circles, a former state party executive director, has run some significant campaigns, including Doug Gross's gubernatorial campaign, and also worked for Mitt Romney's caucus campaign, and then as a regional caucus or a regional campaign director for John McCain. Let's talk about Michael Steele. Professor Goldford, does he deserve another 2 years? Will he get it?
Well, whether he deserves it or not is for Republicans to decide. He's alienated a lot of big donors to the Republican Party. Some have simply closed their wallets and checkbooks. Others have given the money to, say, the Republican Governors Association or a lot of these independent groups. Independent groups are fine. They did very well for Republicans this time around, just as they did very well for Democrats in 06 and 08. But by definition, as independent, you can't control them, and they can somehow and sometimes do things that the party itself they're supposedly aiding might find embarrassing. So the Republican National Committee has got to be front and center in terms of a main organization for collecting campaign donations and distributing funds to various campaigns, coordinating campaigns, and Republicans are looking for a director or leader in that regard they can trust. And the question is whether, I mean, obviously by all appearances, Steele is not something at least a significant number of them trust. But we have an interesting little mini civil war among the Republicans here.
We want to hear from you also on this issue. If you're a Republican, what do you think of the job Michael Steele has done? Are you supportive of a second term? I mean, sweeping many Republicans into office in this recent election. On the other hand, many felt he spoke out of turn, said things that were destructive to the party. And what do you think? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Again, 1-866-780-9100. Professor Moyer, do you think he has a chance considering the wins they just posted?
I don't think really that he has a chance. But on the other hand, he is an African-American and the Republican Party wants to appeal to minorities. Now, I don't know how much he will appeal to minorities, but throwing out their first African-American chair has some significance, I think, or must have some significance in people's thinking.
Is that made a little bit easier by some of the remarks he's made over the past 2 years?
Clearly, yes.
Okay. Let's use this as a jumping off point about what this means for the general health of the Republican Party. I mean, 2 years ago, Professor Goldford, everyone said this party's dead. It needs a huge resuscitative order. What is it going to look like? It could be problematic for 10 years. And boom, 2 years later, huge wins. What's the health of the party?
Well, not everyone, particularly me, said 2 years ago the Republican Party was dead. People tend to leap to conclusions too soon. But they were certainly in big trouble. And to a great extent, as many Republicans admitted, including Cantor and others in Congress, right after the election a month ago, the Republicans don't have a particular Republican mandate. Their mandate was don't be Democrats. In other words, it was an anti-vote. It was a rejection so far of the job that the Obama administration has been doing, although it was admittedly a more Republican-leaning electorate because a lot of the Democrats who came out to the polls in 06 and especially 08 sat on their hands this time, and your opinion doesn't count if you don't register it. But surely the Republicans are in an upswing. They've got to figure out how to deal with the Tea Party because the Tea Party focus is a kind of populist, a right-wing populism financed in some cases by some rather odd kinds of old corporate interests. They can be a mixed blessing for the Republicans. So there's a lot of ferment in the Republican Party, but they definitely know they want to take control of the government again in 2012. And Democrats are still what I've always called a Will Rogers political party. Will Rogers was famously asked, are you a member of a political party? And he said, no, I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And Democrats have acted that way in the past year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Professor Moyer.
What's clear is the Republicans haven't yet won the confidence of the American people. I think I've seen polls the last few days.
So they won the election, but not the confidence.
That's right. And do you trust the Republican Party more than the president? And I think it's pretty close at the moment. So the Republicans have a job to do to gain the full support of the public.
Let's talk to Keenan in Des Moines. Keenan, thanks so much for joining the program.
Oh, thank you. And hello, Dr. Goldford. I'm also a Drake student.
Hi there.
I wanted to comment. He did a good job on bringing in money, but when it came down
and
to
Michael
it,
Steele, you're talking about, let me just, yes, you're talking ma'am. About Michael Steele. Okay,
Michael
go
Steele.
Ahead.
But when it came down to it, I think just the overall dissatisfaction with politics today, it doesn't matter if it's from the Democrat or Republican Party, is the real reason why we saw a change in the political party in the Congress and the Senate. I don't think it was because of one person's funding.
Do you identify yourself with the political party? And if so, if it's Republican, what do you think about Michael Steele? Would you you don't likely get a say in this, but would you support him for a second term? Or do you think, OK, 2 years was enough. Let's move on.
I think we need to look at what he's done and we need to look at what he said and we need to think if he's going to be the best for the party. It's not my decision and I'm not that smart to actually make that decision, but I think it's up to those who we elected to decide.
I think quite often we might say that a party chairman who gets his name in the news isn't getting his job done. A party chairman is a kind of technician to make sure the party machinery operates well and properly and is well funded. And so in that sense, should be beneath the radar or behind the glass, if you will. And Steele's name has been in the news, whether he seems to be promoting a book of his own or various things like that. That's what's engendered some controversy on the parts of Republicans. And Keenan could be right that maybe he's done a good job, but again, there are a lot of donors who thought that he hasn't, and they've just closed their books and or else given money to some other Republican organization.
What about, Professor Moyer, about, you know, that is the popular belief that you should be your work should be speaking for you voice rather than your voice. But now, is that different in the Democratic circles? Because they picked a very high profile a couple of years ago when they picked Howard Dean. You know, he had been vocal. And is it the same for both parties? But
I think at different times you may want different things in terms of a party chair. There are times that you want more publicity. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling that was the case with Harold Dean. And there are other times that you want to focus on candidates and you want to focus on issues and you really want the chair to be in the background.
All right. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. We invite you to join our conversation today at 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Find us on Twitter at IPR Talk. Before we go to the break, and we're going to talk about Afghanistan when we come back and a couple of other hot-button issues, but what do you foresee that then getting done? Do you think the tax bill passes today? Do you think that they'll just that will get done before they go home for the holidays?
I'm confident it'll get done before they go home for the holidays. It just has to get done, I think, in terms of the economy and jobs and unemployment.
Mm-hmm. Professor Goldford, do you agree?
Oh, absolutely. And not just for the positive reason that Professor Moyer just mentioned, but for the negative reason that if it's not done and taxes all of a sudden go up for Americans all over the country, these guys in Washington will have hell to pay.
Mm-hmm. What about the estate tax? I don't know if either of you have followed that at all. As we look at this tax plan, obviously the ethanol extension is good for ethanol producers in Iowa, corn producers in Iowa. Are there other parts of this legislation that are particularly good for this state at all? Do either of you know?
I didn't see other things. I mean, the ethanol, I think, mm-hmm. is the big thing in terms of Iowa. I'm not sure how the estate tax is going to play out in terms of Iowa. There clearly will be some benefits in terms of people with big farms and that sort of thing, but I'm not sure compared to other states just
sure.
how we do.
Professor Goldford, any final thoughts on that?
Well, the estate tax is one of these things that's been demagogued to death. Republicans decided to call it a death tax. There is no such thing as a death tax. And my understanding is that there are exemptions for family farms at a certain level independently of the rest of the estate tax. So I don't see a huge amount of effect here immediately. And, yes, ethanol subsidies will probably remain for a while, John McCain notwithstanding.
One quick question. I should have asked this earlier. Bill Clinton helped the president sell this plan or hurt him, Professor Goldford?
Well, as long as he doesn't seem to undercut the president, he helps sell it among regular Democrats.
All right. We're speaking with Professor Goldford of Drake University and also Professor Wayne Moyer of Grinnell College. We'll be back after this break. You're listening to The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Janine Beck, and this is The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. It's Politics Day, and my guests are Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor and Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College, and Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics at Drake University. Before the break, we were talking about the tax cut policy and also Chairman Steele, but we want to turn our attention now to the loss of U.S. diplomat Richard Holbrooke and what that might mean for our policy in Afghanistan. Obviously, the surge continues at this point, the military or troop surge. But Professor Moyer, Mr. Holbrooke was largely in charge of that region and sort of helping shape that policy. Will it alter now that he is gone, or will we? Are we already far enough along on the course of that?
I think it isn't going to change very rapidly. I think the policy right now is driven by General David Petraeus. And the Obama, having just appointed him to that position, I think has to give him a year or so before he does anything about it. Holbrooke was an enormously dynamic, tough man who could put pressure on people. But I think in the situation of Afghanistan, he wasn't able to bring that pressure to bear very effectively. And the problems of trying to reach some kind of settlement are so difficult. He has made an enormous contribution by settling the Bosnian War in 1995. I should say also about Holbrooke, he came to Iowa in the mid-1970s, 1974 exactly, and spent a week at Grinnell for a big conference on food famine and foreign policy. And I still remember the man's energy and inquisitiveness and how much he wanted to find out about Iowa farming, even though he knew nothing about it. Mm-hmm. And then he wrote an article about Iowa farmers dealing with the world food problem after that.
Mm-hmm. So that was a real treat to have met him.
Yeah, indeed it was. Mm-hmm.
Professor Goldford, you know, when we're in the middle of a situation like Afghanistan where there's an ongoing conflict, when you lose a veteran diplomat like Richard Holbrooke, is that an issue for the administration, or is it something that once that groundwork has been laid that the administration can move forward fairly confidently?
Well, I don't know in a situation like this how much the whole process moves of itself. In other words, people matter, particularly, I think, at the level of diplomacy and negotiation and especially in foreign policy. And so even if Holbrooke were considered an awful person in that role, and he wasn't. Maybe he had his difficulties, but either way, a great person or an awful person, when that person's gone, there's got to be a period of bureaucratic readjustment and substantive policy readjustment to take account of that absence and whoever is going to be in place. As Professor Moyer says, General Petraeus, of course, has a very significant position in this whole thing. Although he's the Teflon coating for he was for President Bush, he is for President Obama. I don't know that he ultimately calls the shots. He does so insofar as the president allows him to do so. But it's as Professor Moyer says, it's a tremendously intractable issue. We oftentimes think that the world is plastic to the American touch. We can just mold things the way we want to do. And maybe there are some places we can, but this is one of those places we simply seem not to be able to do that at all, no matter who's in charge.
You know, I know officials have talked about a goal of ending combat operations by 2014, but we'll have a presidential election in 2012. What does the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan mean for the president?
Well, right now, Americans aren't, except for those who have family members or close friends involved in the military, most Americans aren't paying a huge amount of attention to it. It wasn't a major issue in the election a month ago. Americans are concerned more immediately with whether they're working tomorrow. And if something flares up, something disastrous happens, or if there's another al-Qaeda attack that in some way is rooted in the Pakistani tribal areas or Afghanistan itself, that'll bring it back in a more immediate sense.
In fact, Professor Moyer, I mean, what he just said is almost, and this isn't meant to be critical of the American people, but our distraction by our own economic woes in some way has bought the administration some time possibly to deal with Afghanistan.
I think it's partly that we no longer have a military draft. And so the public doesn't have the same kind of incentives as it had during the Vietnam era. And my guess is this isn't going to come back to be an issue even in 2012, unless, as Professor Goldford says, there's something big that happens in Pakistan. And it won't really be back on the full agenda until 2014.
We want to invite you to join our conversation today. What is the political news that you are most interested in? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Find us on Twitter at IPR Talk. One of the other issues this week that was interesting is that we received some preliminary census data, and we are very likely to lose a congressperson from Iowa because of you know, population that remains stagnant as other states grow. Professor Goldford, I know that, you've been speaking on that. What does that mean when we go from 5 to 4?
Well, you know, what elected politics or electoral politics is about is constituencies. And when we redistrict, all those constituencies get reformulated. I think in the case of the congressional districts, the House seats drastically reformulated. In the case of the state legislative seats, depending upon how they draw them, it may not be as an extreme an example, because there's no talk of changing the Iowa Senate from 50 seats and the Iowa House from 100 seats. But yes, we've got to have we'll lose the seat because our population relative to the country hasn't grown, so we'll go from 5 seats to 4. When I first came to Iowa in the mid-80s, we had 6 and, of course, went down to 5 districts in 1990. That tossed Congressman Nussel and Congressman Nagel, Republican and Democrat, both from northeastern Iowa, into the same district. Now we're going to go to 4, and they've got to be of equal population, respect county and city lines. It's going to be very interesting to see how those districts are going to be drawn, and only then will we know what happens to the person who doesn't get a chair.
Exactly, and that will be the most interesting. I want to ask our listeners, you know, how do you think the line should be drawn? That's pretty difficult maybe for you to spell out, but are there that, I mean, Professor Moyer, that 5th district is only going to get bigger. I mean, it will have 4 districts, but I mean, that western Iowa district is
right.
Going to
well,
be
it's
huge.
Very important, and I'm not sure I fully know yet, but where is the population changing? I mean, the Des Moines area is obvious, and Ames area is obviously increasing. The Iowa City, Cedar Rapids area is obviously increasing. Northern and western Iowa populations decreasing. So, yeah, it's going to have enormous implications.
And when I say the district will be huge, I mean geographically it will be large because there are fewer people in certain areas of the state, and western Iowa is one of those. Go ahead,
just
Professor.
To give you an example about that, if I remember correctly, as of the 2000 census, our current districts, when they started off with the same number of people, the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd districts had anywhere from 12 to 15 counties in them. I think the 4th may have had 22, but to get the same population as 12 or 15 counties in one of the 3 eastern districts, you needed 32 counties in the 5th district in western Iowa, because there's so few people, as you said. You know, who knows how this will happen? Maybe they'll take the Des Moines metro area and combine it with the whole western half of the state and divide the eastern half into 3 separate districts like that. I don't know. They've just got to do all this with the computer program they have.
Well, let me ask you what this means then for possible candidates, because I remember Matt Campbell, who ran against Steve King in the 5th district in this last election, said that he most definitely, if he did not win, intended to run again for higher office. And I remember thinking, but that district is only likely to become less favorable for a Democrat, in my assumption, and depending, I suppose, on how it's drawn. But if it gets bigger, and unless you start to pick up some western suburbs of Des Moines that might be a little more liberal than some western Iowa counties. But what do you see for candidates, Professor Moyer?
Well, my guess is the critical question there is how much of Des Moines and the Des Moines suburbs gets thrown into that 5th district, or what now is the 5th district. And that could make a very considerable difference.
Well, and also you hear names like Christy Vilsack looking at a possible entry into a race, yet we have, you know, we need maybe either someone to retire or a couple to get thrown together before someone like her is going to enter. She most likely wants to do that when a Democrat leaves. And Leonard Boswell said on election night he's going to run again. Professor Goldford, do you see her getting in?
Well, you know, just to put it metaphorically, I don't know that I would want to agree to participate in a car race unless I knew what car I was driving. Mm-hmm. And similarly, you've got to know the terrain. You've got to know the geography of what the districts are before you decide whether or not it's going to likely be a fruitful place for you to run.
Well, that brings me to the next question. Iowa is lauded for having a very nonpartisan process. So in many states, they were thrilled to have Republicans take control because that meant better maps for Republicans after new districts are drawn. But in Iowa, this is a nonpartisan process. It is done by a legislative services agency employees who essentially, as you said, Professor Goldford, use computers, drop the maps. Iowa has to vote them up or down. If they vote down the first map, they can, you know, vote the second one up or down. But the third one, if they don't accept it, courts can come in and make decisions. And in fact, I talked to staff person at the State House who said they're about to move the LSA person who draws the maps out of the building. I mean, the person is literally sequestered from lawmakers during this process so that there isn't political pressure. But do you think there's still some behind the scenes, Professor Moyer?
Oh, I'm sure there's pressure behind the scenes. I think the Iowa process has an enormous amount going for it. It's the kind of process that is likely to draw districts which encourage moderates of both parties in terms of getting their nominations as opposed to extremists, where you structure a district so it's just got mostly Republicans in it or mostly Democrats in it. So I think it's all to the good in terms of both Democratic and Republican candidates that run in future elections.
At the same time, remember, the legislature has to vote to accept it. And the actual districts we have now were the second plan. The first plan was voted down by the legislature in, 2001, I think it was. And they accepted the second plan. The first two tries can't be amended. They're voted up or down on their merits. The third try, they can be amended, and if that doesn't work, then it goes to the courts. So the fact simply that it's not immediately political in the sense of gerrymandering the way it occurs in other states, but still the State House has got to vote for the plan.
And I do remember in 2001 that when once the first plan was rejected and the second plan was put before them, there were members on both sides who were pretty adamant that let's just do this. Let's not start trying to amend things. Let's not go to a third plan that it can only get worse at that point.
That's right. But if I remember correctly, I think one of the reasons the first one was voted down was that there were enough Republicans who argued that district, even if drawn without political considerations in mind, the districts favored the Democrats too much.
Yeah, there's always the map comes out. That's right. Both parties take it back behind closed doors, really study it and try to decide if they feel like, that it gives an edge. And in fact, I think there might have been four Republican senators, state senators, tossed into one district in that one first map. And they weren't happy about that either. And that was going to be four no votes right away. Let's move on and talk about health care reform. Two federal judges in Virginia this week issued diametrically opposed decisions on the constitutionality of the federal health care overhaul, which really does suggest the fate of this act now goes to the Supreme Court. Professor Moyer, is there any other possible outcome?
Oh, absolutely not, since you've got federal judges that are disagreeing with each other, and this is a case with national ramifications. And it all comes down to interpretations of the federal interstate commerce powers and to what extent requiring people to buy health insurance will have economic implications such as it interferes with interstate commerce, plus the power of Congress to pass taxes to improve the public welfare, whether this is beyond what the Constitution gives Congress. And I think it can only be finally resolved by the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm. And so this really does come down to whether the government should be allowed to say, for the greater good, you have to buy health insurance,
exactly,
or whether that's just overstepping their bounds.
Exactly.
Professor Goldford, does it make it – if the Supreme Court would come in and strike this provision down – obviously, the bill is much larger than that single provision, but that has to be bad news for the Obama administration since this is sort of his signature legislation.
Yeah, although interestingly, as some have noted, he opposed this individual mandate when he was running against Hillary Clinton for the nomination. And now is having to defend what he opposed during the primary process. But, some are arguing that if this is struck down, there could be some other ways of dealing with this. But, to the extent that this keeps this in turmoil, what Democrats hoped was just as a fait accompli, just get it done, get it passed, and then when people recognize it's there, they'll learn to live with it and realize, according to the Democrats, that this does work well for them. The Democrats have won two out of three federal court decisions. Still, this keeps it on the front burner and fosters the kind of uncertainty that we talked about earlier with regard to the tax rate issue.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, listeners, do you support this mandate that individuals buy health insurance? Do you think it's the right thing to do so that the pool is broader and that, it's not just the very sick that are in the pool? Or do you think the government has overstepped its bounds in saying that you must do a particular thing? Give us a call, 1-866-780-9100. Again, that number, if you want to weigh in, 1-866-780-9100. Remember, we're on Twitter at IPR Talk, and we also take your emails at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. I know that Professor Goldford just said that Democrats had won two of the three rulings, but yet the Supreme Court, the highest court, has shifted in the last couple of years as new appointments have been made. What's its balance now in the sense of how it might rule?
Well, I think you still have a 5-4 conservative majority, and it's hard to know how the five conservatives. I think the key on this is, as with many other cases, is where does Justice Kennedy go? And I'm not. It's not clear to me how the court will finally rule on this.
Mm-hmm. Professor Goldford, any thoughts on that?
Well, there was a push in the late 90s toward cutting back federal power in the name of federalism, and that, of course, is what a lot of this is about, both the nature of U.S. or federal power and the powers of the states in a federal system. That movement was really sparked and sponsored to a great extent by former Chief Justice Rehnquist. It sort of died out in the early 2000s. Maybe Bush v. Gore was a bit more controversial for most people than federalism cases. But in conservative legal circles, there has certainly been this argument of what they call the Constitution in exile. And that was a pre-New Deal constitution that didn't allow the federal government all these sorts of regulatory powers. It's the sort of things that a lot of the Tea Party folks are hearkening back to when they make their constitutional arguments. And so Professor Moore is right. There's still pretty much of a 4-4 split on the court with Justice Kennedy as the swing vote.
All right. Well, as this wrangling continues, what parts of, does the bill just move forward? I mean, I know states are trying to figure out how to implement this and how to put this in place. Does this hold up everything, or will we see it start to move forward?
I think it's going to move forward, but it's going to create all sorts of problems in that because of the uncertainties. And then if things get reversed, it's going to increase costs, and health insurance companies are going to have a great deal of difficulty adjusting, and I can't imagine that there's any good that comes out of lasting uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. And Professor Goldford, obviously Iowa is an insurance state. Whether you agree with the actual merits of the legislation or not, there is an economic issue for this state.
Oh, sure. I mean, some critics of the bill on the Democratic side who were in favor of a single payer policy suggested that this bill was a bonanza for insurance companies. The insurance companies don't like the requirement that they can't refuse to insure people with pre-existing conditions, but that's one of the big issues for a lot of folks. At the same time, they were going to get, through government subsidies, all sorts of new health insurance customers, and that would make a difference for them. So they have interest, in a sense, on both sides of this issue, and the uncertainty does make this difficult. I did read something earlier this week that suggested, I believe it's the Virginia Attorney General who's pushed this on his own, I think is going to file for some sort of motion to send this directly to the Supreme Court as opposed to going to the Court of Appeals in his district.
All right. Speed things along. Let's talk to Diane real quickly in Cedar Rapids. Diane, thanks for calling the Exchange.
Hi. I guess I wanted to know if since the government requires us to buy motor vehicle insurance to operate a vehicle, what's the big deal about them requiring us to buy health insurance if we want to use the health system?
Well, on the state level, Diane, I do know that the state actually, it's not an entire mandate that you buy vehicle insurance. It's that you either have the car insurance or you have the means to cover the damage that you would. You know, there's sort of this like out that if you have some sort of certificate that says you can afford to cover it, you don't have to carry it. So is there a difference, Professor Moyer?
Well, I don't think the difference is that great. And again, depending on how the Supreme Court actually rules on this, but there are good reasons for the public good why you would want people to have automobile insurance. And there are also very good reasons for the public good why you would want them to have health insurance so that they don't have health insurance. Your public's going to pay for their emergency room bills anyhow. So
I think on that side, though, the argument is made that you can choose not to own a car. And so, therefore, you're exempt from that sort of requirement, whereas the individual mandate says you're a U.S. citizen, you have to have health insurance.
Okay. So there's not an out in the sense of like homeowners insurance, you could just not own a home. I mean, that there are other ways to live your life in those cases, but not in this one.
That's the argument I've seen made, yes.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been Politics Day. I'm Janine Beck. I've been sitting in for Ben Kiefer, and I've been speaking with Wayne Moyer, Rosenfield Professor and Professor of Political Science at Grinnell College. Also, Dennis Goldford, Professor of Politics at Drake University. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer, with assistance from student producer Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support comes from Dennis Reese and John Pemble. Our executive producer of our talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. We have podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. And remember, we welcome your comments and questions about this program or any other at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. This is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Janine Beck. Thanks for joining us.